So we're going to be starting in Genesis chapter 46 this morning. So we're continuing on with Joseph's story. So last week in chapter 45, we saw that Joseph could no longer hold back his emotions. He finally revealed his identity to his brothers. And moved by Judah's plea for Benjamin's release, that way that the younger brother would actually be able to go with him, Judah being willing to step up and take his place, and for the life of his father Jacob, Joseph revealed his identity to him. He embraced them, particularly Benjamin, because that was his full-blooded brother through their mother Rachel. And he explained that God had used his journey to Egypt for good. He told them not to be concerned about the fact that they sold him into slavery, that this was all part of God's plan. Pharaoh's pleased when he hears about the arrival of Joseph's brothers and his father. He says that he's going to provide the necessary means to transport the entire family from Canaan to Egypt, and also that he'll give them the best of what Egypt has to offer. He tells them they can leave all their goods behind. They'll be taken care of when they get there to Egypt. So not only will they live comfortably through the famine that's going on, they're going to have a safe, fertile area in which to prosper when they get to Egypt. So that's kind of where we left off. Pharaoh has sent sent wagons and everything needed to bring all of Joseph's family from Canaan to Egypt. So that's where we're picking up here. So Genesis chapter 46, and this is verse 1. And Israel took his journey with all that he had and came to Beersheba and offered sacrifices unto the God of his father Isaac. So one of the things that we need to know here is we're going to see the name Israel and Jacob used interchangeably all throughout this chapter. So don't let that confuse you. It's just Jacob, Israel. We remember God renamed him. We should also notice Beersheba there. We've heard that name several times. Beersheba being the well of the oath. That's a place where this family has communed with God over and over. Now, you got to think about Jacob's up in years. He has his entire family in Canaan, and now they're being told, leave everything behind and come to Egypt. So it's got to be a hard decision to make. So he sets a pretty good example for us here of what we should do when we're facing a difficult decision. He goes and is going to talk with God. He's going to make sacrifices and pray about this journey they've got to take. And he goes back to Beersheba, the well of the oath, the place where the family has communed with God multiple times. Verse 2, and God spake unto Israel in the visions of the night, and said, Jacob, Jacob. And he said, here I am. Now, one thing I want to note here is in the Hebrew, in verses 1 and 2, the word for God is Elohim. That's what's used in the Hebrew. We'll talk about why that's important in just a minute in the next verse. And here we see Jacob, Jacob. God says it twice. And that's supposed to be symbolic. It's reminding him, because think about it. He doesn't call him Israel. He says Jacob, Jacob, using his old name. He's trying to remind Jacob, Israel, who he was and who he's supposed to be now with God in his life now that he's renamed him. He renamed him to Israel back in chapter 32. So we're, 14 chapters past him being renamed here. So God spoke with Jacob through a dream when he was leaving the promised land the first time back in chapter 28. And he's doing the same thing here. They're getting ready to leave the promised land to go to Egypt. God communes with him through a dream. Verse 3. And he said, I am God, the God of thy father. Fear not to go down into Egypt, for I will there make of thee a great nation. So now we talked about how in the first two verses the word for God is Elohim. In this verse where it says, I am God, in the Hebrew that is El. Okay, it's a different name for God there. Why is that important? This is the same name that's used for God in all of Jacob's earlier encounters with God. So he's telling him to remember the past, who you were, and how I've been with you this entire time, trying to reassure him. So that's the importance there is he's using the same name in the Hebrew that was used every time Jacob spoke with him earlier in Genesis. So in chapter 26, remember, Isaac was forbidden to go to Egypt. God told him, you are not to go to Egypt. And in chapter 15, Abraham was warned against it. He wasn't forbidden, but he was told not to do it. There was a warning there. And Abraham was also told that his descendants would go into a land where they were strangers and would become servants for 400 years. Now, Jacob in Israel is not a dumb person. This is a family history. He would know these things. So that's why he's afraid to go to Egypt. It's like Isaac was told not to go there. Abraham was warned not to go there, and that if we go there, we'll become servants. So he knows this. But God comes to him and explains to him, don't fear to go to Egypt. I will be with you. The family's going to prosper there. And the covenant that I've made that's been repeated down through the generations will still hold true. That promise was given and repeated to Abraham, to Isaac, and down to Jacob. And it's reaffirmed here. God is saying, all of the things I've promised you are still going to come to pass, and your family will still reign over the promised land. Even though you're leaving it now to go to Egypt, I've not forgotten the promise that I made to you. Verse 4, I will go down with thee into Egypt, and I will also surely bring thee up again, and Joseph shall put his hand upon thine eyes. So God tells Jacob, I'll be present with your family, and this is something that we can still count on. That promise still holds true for all of us. When he said that he would be with his people, that promise never went away. It still applies to us to this day, just like it did to them. And he also tells Jacob that he's going to indeed see Joseph. Joseph is alive. You will see him. But more importantly, look there, he says, I will also surely bring thee up again, saying that the family will come out of Egypt. This shows that the plan for the Exodus that's going to happen in the next book is already in motion. God's plan is already moving long before it's going to happen. And historically, we know that Egypt at that time was a very segregated country. They separated themselves by race, by class. They were very segregated. Well, why would that be important? Think about it. We've seen over and over them being punished for intermingling with the different races and different people because they were supposed to keep the bloodline pure for Christ to come through. So by Egypt being a segregated society, it was actually the perfect place for the nation of Israel to be able to grow without intermarriage and losing their identity of Hebrews and becoming part of the locals there. So because the Egyptians would have been wary of them, it kind of kept them segregated to themselves. And by the time the Exodus occurs, they're going to leave in such a multitude that Jacob wouldn't even be able to fathom how large the family would grow. We're going to see a little later in this chapter, at this time, this whole family that started with Abraham 200-some years ago is about 70 people. By the time they leave Egypt in the Exodus, it's going to be roughly 2 million. So this family grows from 70 to 2 million through a period of them being servants under the Egyptians. So don't ever forget that God will work with us even through hard times, and we can come out of it not only okay, but better than we ever could have imagined when we went into it. And verse 5, and Jacob rose up from Beersheba, and the sons of Israel carried Jacob their father and their little ones and their wives in the wagons which Pharaoh had sent to carry him. So think about, we've seen chapter after chapter these brothers walking with this guilt of what they did to Joseph. It colored the way they looked at everything happening with the world, right? They're finally unburdened of that. They're finally being willing to walk in their faith and being willing to leave everything behind. They're going to trust Joseph. He said, come to Egypt. They're going to walk in that faith that he's, you know, going to take care of them, that he doesn't have this revenge plot against them. And this is the brother that they sold into slavery just because he said that they would bow to him. We've seen three times now they've bowed to him. He wasn't wrong. But this can also be a reflection of how we should treat things. They are actually having faith that Joseph will take care of them, someone that they sold into slavery. Well, our salvation comes through Christ that was only sacrificed and put on the cross because of our sins. We caused him to be crucified just like these brothers caused Joseph to be sold into slavery. But Joseph is willing to forgive and watch over them and protect them just like Christ does for us. And verse 6, and they took their cattle and their goods, which they had gotten in the land of Canaan, and came into Egypt, Jacob and all his seed with him, his sons and his sons' sons with him, his daughters and his sons' daughters, and all his seed brought he with him into Egypt. So the family's making good use of the wagons that have been provided by Pharaoh. They're going to take everything with them. But this is almost like a double-edged sword here. They're showing a little bit of a lack of trust, but then an extreme amount of faith at the same time. Pharaoh told them not to bring anything. You'll have better here in Egypt than you could ever have now. Leave everything behind. But it says they bring everything. They loaded everything up with them. So a little bit of a lack of trust, but then at the same time, a great amount of faith because they're bringing everything with them. They didn't leave anything behind of like, well, if this doesn't go well in Egypt, we'll come back to Canaan. They packed up and took everything with them. So it's kind of a weird juxtaposition there. But notice that it says that all of his seed is brought with him. Again, this is setting up the Exodus that we'll see later from Egypt. There was none of his family left behind. They will all be in Egypt. Now, I wanted to note here that the genealogies we're going to see here, we're about to go through a bunch of names. It's genealogies. We'll kind of move quick through them. But they're arranged according to the mother of each brother. So it goes in the order of Leah, and then Zilpah, Rachel, and Bilhah. But this is also one of those chapters that someone that's going to be a critic of the Bible will try to use to be a stumbling block for you. They'll say, well, look at these genealogies. Now let's go to Numbers 26 and 1 Chronicles 2 through 8. Look, they don't line up. There's something that doesn't line up here. But this genealogy is in parallel to the one we'll see in Exodus chapter 1. The difference there being this genealogy and in Exodus is focusing on the people. The ones that we see in Numbers and Chronicles focus on the tribes. So there's a difference, but it's because the subjects are different. They're not trying to line up the same things. And here in this genealogy, same thing happens in Genesis 10 and Exodus 1, we're getting to 70 people through Israel. That's the number we're trying to get through. You guys all know, we go over time after time that numbers in the Bible mean something. 70 is 7 times 10. 7 is spiritual perfection, the signature of God. Okay? 10 is ordinal perfection, new beginnings. So the point of it getting the genealogy to 70 is showing through God, this is a new beginning. This is the family through which Christ comes that we all get a chance at a new life in the eternity. We can put our sins behind us. So the reason it gets to 70 is it's trying to tell us something through the numbers. Now, verse 8. Again, we're going to be looking through some names. We'll kind of move quick through these. Hopefully, I don't butcher these too badly. So verse 8. And these are the names of the children of Israel, which came into Egypt. Jacob and his sons, Reuben, Jacob's firstborn. And the sons of Reuben, Hanok and Phallu, and Hezron and Carmi. In verse 10, and the sons of Simeon, Jemuel and Jamin and Ohad and Jochin and Zohar and Shaul, the son of a Canaanitish woman. I want to pause there and make a note there. It says that sons of a Canaanitish woman. This means Canaanite by region, not by blood. So just like you could be an American because you were born here and you're of American descent, or if you're an immigrant and come here and you become a legal immigrant and you get your, what's the word I'm looking for here? Citizenship, thank you. If you get your citizenship, you're an American, right? You're not blood American, but you're American by region. That's what this is talking about. This was not a Canaanitish woman through blood. She was just Canaanitish because that's the region in which she lived. Again, important because of keeping the bloodline pure that had to be the Hebrew bloodline for Christ to come through. So verse 11. And the sons of Levi, Gershon, Kohath, and Merari. And the sons of Judah, Er and Onan, and Shelah, and Perez, and Zerah. But Er and Onan died in the land of Canaan, so they're not with them, but we name them in the genealogy. And the sons of Perez were Hezron and Hamul. Now two of those names should kind of sound familiar to us. So Perez and Zerah come from Tamar. That was the daughter-in-law that Jacob ended up having relations with after his sons had died when he didn't realize it was her. Zerah was the start of the people of the Red Hand. If you guys remember us going through that, that was the people that were the direct lineage that we could trace all the way to Ireland and Scotland with the sigils that were on their flags and the different coat of arms. Perez is the direct descendant of Christ. So we always want to circle his name because that is the lineage that we follow down to Jesus. And again, when we went over the people of the Red Hand, that's why I thought that was important. Because if we can prove the descendants of Zerah all the way down to people today, then you can also prove his twin brother's lineage and know that you, if you want to argue over the divinity of Christ, have at it. But you cannot deny he existed. Because we have the bloodlines and the genealogies to show all the way down to Christ historically. So that's why it's important to notice those two names there. So verse 13. And the sons of Issachar, Tola and Phuvah, and Job and Shimron. And the sons of Zebulon, Sarid and Elon and Jalil. And these be the sons of Leah, which she bare unto Jacob in Padanaram, with his daughter Dinah. All the souls of his sons and his daughters were 30 and 3. Verse 16. And the sons of Gad, Zephion and Haggai, Shunai and Esbon, Eri and Arodi and Areli. And the sons of Asher, Jimna and Ashua and Asui and Beriah, and Sarah their sister, and the sons of Beriah, Heber and Malchiel. Verse 18. These are the sons of Zilpah, whom Laban gave to Leah his daughter, that was the handmaiden given to Leah when they were married, and these she bare unto Jacob, even 16 souls. So verse 19, the sons of Rachel, Jacob's wife, Joseph and Benjamin. They only had two. That was his favorite wife, Rachel, the favorite two sons, Joseph and Benjamin. Verse 20, and unto Joseph in the land of Egypt were born Manasseh and Ephraim, which Asenath, the daughter of Potipharah, priest of On, bare unto him. Now, we keep talking about they had to keep the bloodline pure for Christ. So that could throw a monkey wrench in there, right? We have that Joseph married Asenath while he's in Egypt. Asenath was from a region called Goshen, and she belonged to a group of people called the Hyksos, the shepherd kings, which were of Hebrew descent. So we're going to talk about in a few minutes about the actual Pharaoh that's ruling over this time while Joseph's there. And we're going to see he's actually one of the first foreign rulers of Egypt. And we don't even just have to get that information from the Bible. You can go and look up this Pharaoh and look at all the historical references we have to him and see this was the first Pharaoh over Egypt that had Hebrew descent. This wife of Joseph was from the same group of people from the same region of Egypt called Goshen. So verse 21. And the sons of Benjamin were Bela and Becher and Ashbel, Gera and Naaman, Eha and Rosh, Muppam and Huppam and Ard. These are the sons of Rachel, which were born to Jacob. All the souls were 14. Verse 23. And the sons of Dan, Hushim, and the sons of Naphtali, Jazil and Guni and Jezer and Shillem. These are the sons of Bilhah, which Laban gave unto Rachel his daughter, and she bare these unto Jacob. All the souls were 7. So this was the other handmaiden that was given to the other daughter. So verse 26 here. All the souls that came with Jacob into Egypt, which came out of his loins, beside Jacob's sons' wives, all the souls were 66. That means 66. Now we said before it's 70. We'll see that in the next verse. We'll kind of explain what we see here. So the 66 in this verse just applies to those that made the journey to Egypt from Canaan. That's the group that was in Canaan and came to Egypt. We'll see the full genealogy in the next verse. Now the phrase, out of his loins, is used to show the difference of the numbers that we see in this chapter compared to in Acts chapter 7, it shows 75 instead of 66. But the difference here being the out of his loins, because it includes Jacob and all of his kindred when we go to Acts. And in 1 Chronicles chapter 7, it actually gives us the identity of those extra 9. So we don't even have to question, well, where did these extra 9 come from? When we get to 1 Chronicles, it will show us exactly who those extra 9 were. And part of the reason why we get some of these different numbers is in Acts, Stephen is actually quoting what's called the Septuagint. We kind of talked on that about that Thursday night. The Septuagint is the first Greek translation of the Old Testament. So in Acts, that's what Stephen is quoting from, and it includes the entire group, not just the direct descendants of Jacob. So that's why we have some different numbers. Again, Bible critics will try to use these different numbers to say the Bible contradicts itself. It doesn't. We just have to put everything in the right box and order everything in the right way. So verse 27, and the sons of Joseph, which were born him in Egypt, were 2 souls. All the souls of the house of Jacob, which came into Egypt, were 70. So this verse is the 70. So this figure, the way we get this, and I mean, don't need to do it now, but if you're curious and want to do it later, you can go back and count the names we just went through. When you add those up, and then you add Joseph, his 2 sons, and Jacob, that's the 66 plus 4, we get to the 70 people. That's how we get that number. Now, think all the way back from everything we've gone through in here in Genesis. When Abraham and Sarah were just wanting that one child. Remember, they were older. They couldn't have children. God says he's going to bless them. Give them just one child. We started with 2 people just trying to have the one child. It's been 215 years, and we're at 70 people. 215 to get to 70. Now, just quick math. So if we're, say, 200 and we got to 70, in another 400 years, if we went at that same rate, we'd expect to be around 210 people, right? 70, 70, 70. Or even if we wanted to go exponentially, we could say 70 plus 140, that's 210, plus another 280, so somewhere in 500 people, even if we're growing at the same rate. But in 430 years, when the family leaves Egypt, it will be 2 million. So we're not even growing at the same rate. When God said, I will bless you, he means it. But now it's on his time. not on the time they wanted it to happen, and in a place they probably didn't want to go, where they were all being treated as slaves and servants, they were treated as lesser than, but went from 70 people to 2 million in a time that really they probably should have grown to 500. So always remember that God will work with us no matter where we're at, and when it's his plan, it's not on our time. But when he says it's time, it will happen quickly. So verse 28. And he sent Judah before him unto Joseph to direct his face unto Goshen, and they came into the land of Goshen. So Goshen is a place that's northeast. It's the northeastern part of the Nile Delta. You can look on maps and see where it would be to this day. It was east of Memphis, not Memphis, Tennessee, Memphis, Egypt. It was east of that area. And it was called the Field of Zoan, Z-O-A-N. And you'll find that in Egyptian inscriptions. So the Field of Zoan is described as an area that had non-Egyptian inhabitants. So Egyptian history says that area of Goshen, that's where all the non-Egyptians live in Egypt. So the Hebrews, the Hyksos, those shepherd kings, Jacob and his family, we'll see, will be put there. That's where all the Hebrews of the area were. So Judah gets sent before the family to get their dwelling prepared. So they're coming into Egypt. You know, it's a larger group. They're probably moving a little bit slower. And they say, Judah, you go ahead of us to make sure everything's ready for us. Now, remember, Judah is the direct lineage of Christ. Judah is the bloodline that goes directly down to Christ. And this is foreshadowing exactly what Christ does for us. Okay, Judah goes into Egypt to prepare their place in Egypt, right? What does it say in John 14:2 that Christ does for us? In my Father's house are many mansions. If it were not so, I would have told you. I go to prepare a place for you. Doing exactly what his ancestor did, going before us to prepare our place. Now, it's kind of a side note from what we're looking at in Genesis, but I also wanted to touch on this verse is one of the most misunderstood verses in the Bible. First and foremost, can you fit mansions in your house? It says, in my Father's house are many mansions. This does not mean when we get to heaven, we're going to have a 10-bedroom, 8-bath, 3-car garage house. That's not what this means. It just means a dwelling place, a spot for us in heaven. We're not going to go and have some big, beautiful mansion. That's not what it's trying to talk about. I think it'll be greater than that. We're going to be in the eternal life in heaven with God the Father with us. So if you're worried about a big house when you get there, we're probably focusing on the wrong things about what the eternal life is going to be. But I just wanted to touch on that because I have so many of my family members that are like, I can't wait to get there. I'm curious, how will I decorate my mansion? I'm like, you're not understanding what this verse is telling you. You're not even reading the first part of it because it says, in my Father's house are many mansions. I can't fit a mansion in my house. God's house is probably a lot bigger, but I don't think that's what he means there. So I just wanted to touch on that. But again, the direct example, Judah going before the family to set their place, Christ goes before us to prepare our place. So back to Genesis 46, verse 29. And Joseph made ready his chariot and went up to meet Israel, his father, to Goshen and presented himself unto him. And he fell on his neck and wept on his neck a good while. So Joseph finally sees Jacob. It's 22, 23 years at this point. Jacob thought he had been killed. Joseph's been through being a slave, been in prison. Now he's in a pretty good place, but been through some terrible things. It was probably a really emotional, you know, time for them to come back together that way. Now verse 30, and Israel, Jacob, said unto Joseph, now let me die, since I have seen thy face, because thou art yet alive. Now I don't think he's literally saying, like, let me die, kill me. He's saying that my life's complete. My life has been fulfilled. He's explaining this overwhelming joy that he's feeling from seeing Joseph alive and well, his favorite son from his favorite wife that he's thought has been dead for over two decades. Verse 31. And Joseph said unto his brethren and unto his father's house, I will go up and show Pharaoh and say unto him, my brethren and my father's house, which were in the land of Canaan, are come unto me. And the men are shepherds, for their trade has been to feed cattle. And they have brought their flocks and their herds and all that they have. So Joseph's saying, you know, I'm the right-hand man of Pharaoh. He's going to want to meet my family when they're here. And when he meets you, he's already going to know that you're shepherds because I'm going to tell him that. And after promising the best that Egypt has, they're going to give them areas there in Goshen, which is a fertile area, as shepherds that they can use. Now, just like we just saw with Judah being an example of Christ, Joseph is now doing the same thing, being an example of Christ. Think about it. He provided for them during the famine. He gave them all the food and grain and everything they needed to be taken care of during a bad time. And that's just like how Christ provides for us now in the flesh life, which in the grand scheme of things is the bad time compared to the eternal and heaven, right? This is the famine for us. But he still provides just like Joseph gave them grain. I have a verse here, Matthew chapter 6, verse 25. It says, "Therefore I say unto you, take no thought for your life, what you shall eat or what you shall drink, not yet for your body, what you shall put on. Is not the life more than the meat, and the body the raiment?" So in the Gospel of Matthew, Christ speaking directly saying, don't worry about how you're going to be taken care of in the flesh. I know you need these things. You'll be taken care of. And then Philippians 4:19 says, "But my God shall supply all your need according to his riches and glory by Christ Jesus." You'll be provided for. You'll have everything you need. And then probably one of the most famous verses that everyone knows, Psalms 23:1, "The Lord is my shepherd, I shall not want." We won't need anything. And Joseph provided for them in the famine, like Christ provides for us now in the flesh. But then after the famine, Joseph goes before the family to advocate to them, to Pharaoh, to ensure their safety and place in the kingdom of Egypt. Christ goes before us to prepare our place in the kingdom of God, doing the same thing, going before us to talk to God to prepare our place. And we have an example of exactly that. Matthew 25:34 says, "Then shall the king say unto them on his right hand, Come, ye blessed of my Father, inherit the kingdom prepared for you from the foundation of the world." Preparing our place in the kingdom. We've just seen two examples of it. The Bible's always trying to prepare us for the end times and what's to come. So all the way back in Genesis, it's still pointing us towards Christ and what he would do for us. And then verse 33. So this is back in Genesis 46, verse 33. "And it shall come to pass when Pharaoh shall call you, and you shall say, What is your occupation? That you shall say, The servant's trade hath been about cattle from our youth, even until now, both we and also our fathers, that you may dwell in the land of Goshen, for every shepherd is an abomination unto the Egyptians. So tell them your shepherds, that way you get put in Goshen." Now we talked about how Egypt is segregated. That's what it's referring to here about the shepherds being an abomination to the Egyptians. So they probably thought that foreign herdsmen were competition for their resources. They had to divide by race, by class, by occupation. So it's just kind of a general disdain for foreigners and for their class, and especially foreigners from Canaan. They called them Asiatics in the Egyptian text, so we see them referenced. But he says here that whenever they speak with Pharaoh, they're going to kind of have this common bond with Pharaoh. You may wonder, well, why if they're segregated like this, would the Egyptian king have this common ground with them? This is where we get into that historical there, that this is Apepi is his name, A-P-E-P-I, Apepi, the Pharaoh during Joseph's time. He was one of the Hyksos, the shepherd kings. Again, the first time a foreign ruler had ruled over Egypt. So you have someone that was from those shepherd families ruling over Egypt, where he was kind of looked down upon before he became Pharaoh, welcoming in a shepherd's family. So that's why they would have a common bond there. Now, Jacob and Joseph are finally reunited after over two decades here, since Joseph was originally sold into slavery and they lied to Jacob about him being killed. So after spending time with his father, Joseph prepares the family for their audience with Pharaoh, and he tells them what to say to ensure that they're given that fertile pasture land in Goshen in the north of Egypt. So this chapter should just remind us of the importance of trusting in God's guidance. Even when it leads us into unfamiliar places, if it takes us into difficult places, if it means that we have to make a change in our life, have faith in God and his plan. Jacob was leaving the land that was promised to his forefathers to go into Egypt. God had promised that this family would have this place, and now he's being told he needs to leave it, to go to a foreign land. But remember, difficult decision. The first thing he does is he goes to Beersheba, the well of the oath, and communes with God. He goes to God to discuss everything with him. And God reassures him, I'll be with you. Promises haven't changed. You'll still inherit exactly what I told you you would. And the lesson for us in that is that when life requires that change or uncertainty, just put faith in the fact that God's with us. Faith means that we can move forward during that uncertainty with courage, knowing that God's plan will come to pass. We can trust in him even if that means going through a change. And even though our circumstances may change and we may face uncertainty, we can always remember this verse from Hebrews 13:8. Jesus Christ, the same yesterday and today and forever. He's never going to leave us. He'll never forsake us. If we'll accept him into our hearts and lives, our lives will be what change. And he will walk with us every single day, meaning yesterday, today, tomorrow, and every day after. He doesn't change. He will be with us.